All right, so we're recording. Thanks everybody for joining us. Today is June 10th. My name is Nettie Lagasse. I'm the Associate Director for Programs at NYISO, and this is the open teleconference for June, which is on the topic of transfer. With me, I have two colleagues from the Transfer Standing Committee. We have James Philpotts, who is Head of Content Delivery Digital at Oxford University Press, and James, thank you, is serving as the co-chair of the standing committee. We also have Linda Wabi. Linda is the e-journal relations manager at Skelk in California. And Linda, I'm sorry, I may have just botched your last name. How do you say your last name?
It's Wobie. It's fine.
Yeah. Wobie. Wobie, thank you. As a person with a last name that is often not pronounced right, I sympathize. So thanks. So the way that our open teleconferences work, it's really pretty informal. We are just going to be chatting with Linda and James about transfer for a while. We will invite you to ask questions about transfer. There'll be time for that. If there's something that you absolutely need to know in the middle of the call, that's okay too. Interrupt us. I would, though, ask if you aren't speaking and you're in a noisy area, maybe in your office or your office area, that you might mute your phone so that any unwanted noise does not carry on. To do that, you can press *6 to mute and *6 to unmute. And if there's a lot of noise, I will mute you, but don't worry about that. So I will unmute when the time comes. So thanks again. And all right, so here we go, James and Linda. Could we talk about what is in the transfer code of practice and who should read and use it? That's kind of a big question. Let's see, who wants to take that? James, you're co-chair, so why don't you start off with the big one?
Okay. Hi, Nettie. So the code contains best practice guidelines for publishers to follow over journal transitions. So that's when the responsibility for a journal moves from one publisher to another. So often journals are actually owned by third-party organizations, societies, or they might be owned by the publishers themselves. And then contractual arrangements move from one publisher to another. So those are the kind of transfers that we're talking about. And the code covers activities for both publisher parties in this process, so the transferring publisher and the receiving publisher. And the aim is to ensure that the journal content remains easily accessible by librarians and readers when these transfers occur, and that the process happens with minimum disruption. So historically, there have sometimes been issues with those happening, both in terms of publisher processes or worst case scenario, kind of access going down for people. And that's obviously not a desirable situation. So a strong kind of emphasis really of the code and in the original genesis for it was that concern over continuing access to digital resources. Mm. But it also tackles other practical kind of considerations as well, open access stuff, licensing information, handling of URLs, redirects. And while it's publishers who are the ones who, as I say, are asked to endorse the code, transferring and receiving publishers, we also want to make sure we've got good engagement going on with librarians out there, the societies I mentioned who might own those journals, and other third parties, for instance, Crossref, who are involved in these kind of transfers, to make sure that everyone sort of understands it and knows what they can expect.
Right. No, it's always good for everyone to have an idea of what's expected from everyone, I guess. So, Linda, how does transfer assist participants and people who are affected, so to speak, in the transfer process?
Thanks, Nettie. I think it's really important to think about the people on the committees that put these things together, because the transfer code was really created by people involved in this work. So it's a very practical set of instructions. And I think people who embark on reading it will be happy to find out it's short. So it's just 7 pages of practical information. And for example, the receiving publisher roles and responsibilities, only 1.5 pages long, and it's, you know, big type. So it's, and it's not, sometimes when I'm talking to publishers, the fear is that it's going to tell them exactly what they're supposed to do, but it's not couched in that way. It's the issues that the two publishers need to communicate to each other and decide for themselves how they want to handle. For example, with perpetual access, the transferring publisher who's made that contractual relationship with their subscribers has a responsibility to ensure that perpetual access is provided to whomever they've made that promise. But the transferring or receiving publisher may provide that access, or it may be an archiving site. So there's no specification as to exactly how everything is supposed to happen. It's just topics that the publishers need to address. And yeah.
Good. James, you know, I had mentioned that everyone should be sure about what's going on with everybody, but could you, since you're a publisher, I guess you're the best person to talk about publisher perspective. Can you say what's the value in transfer compliance from a publisher's perspective? Why should a publisher look into transfer and do whatever work needs to be done internally to comply with our recommendations?
Sure. So I guess there are kind of two parts to that. There's sort of an internal piece and a more sort of external facing one. So in terms of sort of the internal process, is for publishers, just the activities set out and understood, those responsibilities, how that splits between the transferring publisher and the receiving publisher, is it extremely helpful. It gives you you know, kind of framework to work within, not having to invent things from scratch when you deal with one of these transfers. So for a smaller publisher, for instance, they might only come across one of these scenarios pretty infrequently and be unsure of the steps they need to take. So just having that sort of set out is helpful. And larger publishers as well, you know, they might be doing this more regularly, but it's really helpful for them to have these processes ready to go at scale and, as I say, understand their responsibilities between being a transferring and receiving party. So there's that kind of internal piece to it. It helps publishers know what they're meant to be doing and set their processes up accordingly for when these things happen. And then there's an external kind of facing bit that as well. So signing up and saying you're compliant obviously makes it clear to people, whether those are the librarians that you're serving as your customers, or whether it's societies that you might be working with, that you understand and take your responsibilities seriously, that you understand the challenges that are involved in doing this, and you're committed to making sure that process is smooth, sort of ready and willing to follow best practices. And it gives reassurance as well when you're a publisher and you're dealing with another publisher in one of these transitions, these transfers of a journal, that you know that the other publisher is also compliant, that they also understand their responsibilities. There's not going to be sort of awkward points where, you know, you reach a period of time and they're not sending you some information or you're not communicating something. Everyone sort of understands what they need to do. You've got a framework for those kind of responsibilities, actions and timelines. And I think it's also worth kind of pointing out that there's not a significant commitment to doing this. So, you know, you endorse and then, you know, you might not have a transfer for a period of time. So it's sort of being ready for when these scenarios arrive. And having the processes set up after perhaps an initial piece of time to make sure that you're doing compliant, there isn't sort of ongoing burden after that. You know, it's making sure that everything's kind of ready and working. It's not, I wouldn't say it's a significant burden.
It's not a technical kind of this piece of it is not tech. So what does it entail for a publisher to endorse transfer?
Yeah, so like I said, both you and Linda said actually that, you know, it's a short kind of document and it's not tech heavy with things, although there's a few bits and pieces that are starting to creep in maybe now that, you know, there's more and more sort of digital processes going on, the technology keeps on evolving, there are perhaps a few little bit more technical pieces creeping in, but it's certainly not a tech heavy kind of standard at all. And our aim is just to make sure that we get broad compliance, that these things are understood out there in the industry, the publishers know what they're meant to be doing. So we wanted to make it really straightforward to understand and also straightforward to endorse. So if a publisher wants to endorse transfer, they just simply need to commit to abide by the principles of the code whenever it's feasible for them to do so. So there might be some contractual kind of limitations possibly. So we're kind of aware of that. But wherever possible, they sign up to cover the activities that are needed in the code. They just need to provide us then with a named contact, and as you know, they're listed on the site, so anyone can kind of go and see who are the endorsing publishers and who's the named contact at that publisher in case there was a query over a transfer process. And they get mm-hmm. access to that list. And then we also set them up with access to an alerting service that we have. So this transfer alerting service is a place where they are required to post a notification of a transfer when one occurs. So that's one of the kind of required actions for an endorsing publisher. So that's, you know, just sort of signing up, providing a name, making sure their processes comply, and being ready when they have one of these transfers to follow those processes and announce it to the wider world. That's basically what it takes. A fairly small sort of investment of time, I'd say.
Yeah, so hopefully that's all pretty low overhead. Just, you know, in terms of their, probably the hardest thing is just reading the document maybe, but Linda, we mentioned earlier, I mean, it's a sort of a little bit of a publisher-centric recommendation because all the processes are the responsibility of the publishers, but how should obviously librarians care that journal transfers take place pretty smoothly, so how should a librarian talk to their vendor about this, and what is the value of transfer for a librarian?
Yeah, thanks, Nettie. Yes, it's kind of too late to talk to them after you find out that your perpetual access is not accessible, but so you can look for transfer compliance in your licenses. I work for a consortium that negotiates licenses on behalf of 300 member libraries. So we're always on the lookout for that. And that's one of the things, the perpetual access rights is one of the things that compliant publishers will notify where it's going, which publisher is going to be. They'll publish the information about the transfer on the transfer alerting service, such as who the receiving publisher is, what the new URL is, what the effective date of the transfer is. So all that information is something that librarians are deeply concerned about. We're just coming into the transfer season where those notifications will start going out. So if a librarian discovers a publisher involved in a transfer that they are aware of doesn't know about the code, you can direct them to the NISO site, which includes the contact information. Basically, it's alert a member of the standing committee. Because we approach publishers, especially when we see that a publisher is involved in a transfer on one side of the equation or the other, and they aren't an endorser. So it's great when we make those approaches if librarians have been saying, gee, we think you should be transfer compliant. And so we can get the notifications on the transfer alerting service site. If a publisher is primed when we come marching up as a member of the committee and say, we would like you to sign up, I think that it would be really helpful.
So it's always a good time to talk to a vendor about the value of transfer.
That's right.
Good. One of the major undertakings for the Transfer Standing Committee over the last year was actually updating the recommended practice, which I think was last published in 2014. So that was a lot of work for the members. Well, maybe not too much work for the members of the committee, but more work for the co-chairs who were organizing all of that. So James, since you were the person, I think, who was actually, you know, managing all the changes to the document, could you describe what kinds of changes were included in this update that is transfer 2019 version 4?
So yeah, we made quite a number of changes this time around. A lot of them are sort of fairly small kind of textual changes, but there were some fairly significant points as well. So one was that we really looked at the section was previously described as being subscriber information on the code and updated some of the terminology around that quite sort of significantly. So we talk about customers with paid access now rather than subscribers, and that's as business models continue to evolve and the way that publishers are describing and handling this information sort of changing. We were finding that referring to sort of a subscriber to a journal was getting more and more sort of out of date. We want to just be clear that we were talking about any customer who's got paid access. So we've kind of revised quite a bit of the wording around that point, which I think quite a significant one. Apart from that, a number of changes were made just to sort of keep pace with, all the rapid kind of change that is the normal thing in our industry. So, as I said, business models change, terminology changes, technology complexity is always kind of evolving. We wanted to make sure that things were kind of keeping pace with that. So some of those other kind of more minor perhaps bits and pieces that we tweaked was we had a section around licensing terms before, and what we were really driving at there was saying if something was open access, so it was meant to be kept perpetually available through the licensing terms. So we just kind of clarified that a bit and made sure that it was clear what we were actually talking about there. We addressed some concerns that had been highlighted to us by link resolvers as well. So with regard to sort of clear communications that they needed, we hadn't quite sort of covered that in the previous version. What else? We rearranged some points as well about pre-publication content. So this is where a publisher might have some content in their submission system still, so it's still kind of going through that process, or perhaps it's kind of at a midpoint of in the production process that they have, but isn't actually reached publication yet. So we wanted to make sure that was clear. And we updated as well some of the guidance that we had around making sure that links and redirects were in place, as feasible. There's some technical kind of issues around that means we can't be kind of too prescriptive about it, but we made sure that the intent was clearer in the code. So yeah, quite a few revisions and tweaks this time around. So I think the main bit was really around that clause for paid customers rather than subscribers, but yeah, definitely a fairly sort of substantial change to the last version, and we're now trying to make sure that we have a more regular process for doing that. So we're going to institute a sort of 3-year revision cycle to make sure that we keep up to date. Otherwise, these things can slip a little bit and go out of date.
Yeah, no, certainly, certainly there's a lot that's changing in our industry, so I think there will be changes to transfer will not be a static document for too
No,
long.
definitely not. It's amazing how much that does change between each time that we come to look at it, to be honest. So yeah, it's
Yeah.
stuff to keep up to date with.
So, speaking of keeping up to date, Linda, could you talk about the transfer alerting service and how you receive information about things that are and sort of invoked under transfer that are affected by transfer? What's the best way to manage that?
Well, thanks. Yes, personally, I subscribe to the email alerts, but it's kind of a lot of information.
So,
But
what is the email alert? So that's
so
when a transfer. Go ahead. Sorry.
yeah. So when transfer information has been posted to the site by a publisher, I will get an email. Everybody who subscribes to the email alert will get an email which gives the basic information about the title and which is the transferring publisher and who is the receiving publisher. But I kind of store it in my mind that, something has happened with a group of Sage titles, for example, or a group of Wiley titles. And then when I really want to get to the details, then I go and search the transfer alerting service site, which hosts a database, which has fantastic all the good information. What was the URL? What is going to be the URL? What is the effective date? all the information about the perpetual access, and that it's but this tie between the two sites, because there's the NISO site, NISO transfer site, where the code is and the list of compliant publishers sits, and there's a link from that site to the transfer alerting service and vice versa. And the transfer alerting service, which we affectionately call TAS, is hosted now by ISSN. So at the same time we were working diligently on back and forth the drafts of the new transfer code, the ISSN representative on the committee suggested that the transfer alerting service should be hosted at the ISSN site to make it convenient for publishers who are going to have to register their ISSN to also submit the transfer data at that same site. And that was, of course, brilliant. And so those two things were happening at the same time, which I think was pretty amazing that it was all pulled off at about the same time. And so the transfer alerting service, the email alerts, I maybe don't get all of the details that I can get when I go to the actual transfer site, because what's really super cool about the site is if all you can remember is something happened to some Wiley titles, you can type in Wiley and the date range that you're interested in, say sometime in 2018 to the end of 2019 right now, and find out what transfers are set to take place, or 2019 to 2020, see what's coming up for 2020. So I think that's a really fantastic thing that's available. So I can get the alert, but I can go to the site and search all that great information. I don't know.
That's
I
great. So that really
a lot more about that. Yeah.
But no, that really helps you in your work as you're trying to manage the publishers and their titles. Keeps you informed. What happens if you see a transfer activity, and probably you'd learn about it a different way? A transfer-related activity from a publisher who hasn't endorsed transfer. Does that happen? Oh, I guess, yeah, I was asking you. Sorry, I was continuing on. Yeah. So sorry about that.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. So what happens if, as a librarian, I find out that maybe a publisher, like I just got an email today that says, oh, we're losing these titles and we're gaining those titles, and they aren't transfer compliant. I don't have all of the information that I need. I don't have the new URL. I don't possibly know who the new publisher is going to be. And I don't know the exact volume and issue number that's going to be involved. So I'm definitely at a disadvantage. Libraries who are trying desperately to keep information up to date in their catalogs, we talked earlier about, asking them if they might want to endorse the code. So you don't have to send out an email saying, well, what's the URL? Who's the new publisher? When is this really going to happen? That information is almost never included in the marketing information that says, oh, we have this new title, or we're losing that title. And but the committee has had numerous successes signing up publishers just by letting them know how important it is and how easy it is, and all the information is now at the ISSN site where they can post the information. We actually have a spreadsheet of target publishers. If we find a publisher that hasn't, that's been involved in a transfer, mostly we've been focusing on the receiving publishers. And because it seems like the big publishers are mostly signed up, but not all of them. That are typical receiving publishers for transfers. And so we have a target spreadsheet, and we divide them up among the committee, and so they can look for us coming to them in the exhibit hall. And for a librarian that's finding out that information, we really appreciate hearing about it so we can help the publisher sign up to comply with the transfer code.
Great. Yeah, so hopefully the number of publishers who haven't heard or endorsed transfer gets smaller and smaller as time goes by. James, could you say a little bit about the Transfer Standing Committee, specifically how our stakeholders represented? That's an important part of the input to the Transfer Committee. And then also, what are the current activities? What's going on with the Standing Committee now? James, are you there?
Hi, yeah, sorry. So the Standing Committee is a pretty mixed group, deliberately so. So we're split between publishers, librarians, and that sort of includes both kind of directly institutions, but also we've got some consortia representatives now as well. So that's really good news. And also other third parties who might be involved have a stake in these kind of transfers. So I think I mentioned Crossref earlier. They're one of those kind of third parties we want to make sure we're involved too. So we aim to make sure there's a good balance across the group between those different groups, and obviously in particular between the publishers and librarians. So if, you know, it's too heavily weighted towards publishers, we might sort of descend into talking about kind of publisher specific considerations and sort of technicalities of transferring things. And you know, we need to make sure that there's a balance to the librarians' concerns as well, so publishers can make sure they're talking about the kind of practical considerations of some of the things that that librarians need and are asking for. So it's good to have that real mix across the group. And we're sort of roughly 50, if you took out the third parties, the remainder is sort of roughly 50-50 split between publishers and librarians, and then, as I say, a number of sort of third-party group representatives too. To help keep that balance as well, we've got co-chairs. So I think you mentioned right at the beginning, I'm one of the co-chairs at the moment. I'm the publisher representative for that. And we also got a librarian representative as well. That's Jennifer Baisley. She's currently at Miami University. And we make sure that the group meets every couple of months. And you asked about what we're sort of looking at as well. So, you know, we focus on maintaining the code. We talked about the fact we've just had a big kind of round of revisions and got to the latest version. We also discuss any other kind of queries or issues that might come up. So you might be contacted by people who've you know, got a query about how the process might work, or kind of questions from publishers or librarians about a particular scenario, and like, how do you think we should approach this? So we talk about that kind of stuff, and also looking for opportunities to promote and present the work as well. So we make sure that if there are speaking opportunities, so you know, ALA is coming up, for instance, very soon, that we have you know, we have representation there. People kind of give sessions, talk at these kind of conferences or other situations where we might be able to kind of promote the work. We've got a few kind of current priorities as well, beside that sort of outreach sort of process. So we want to make sure that we're not just talking to librarians and publishers, but we're, one of the things we're talking about at the moment is how we get in front of societies a little bit more. So it'd be great if they could talk about the code when they're discussing things with potential publishing partners or their existing publishing partners as well. And there might be something that can be included, you know, a note in any agreement or contract around being transfer compliant. That would be great. So we'd love to have a little bit more of a conversation with societies. Linda mentioned earlier about encouraging further publisher endorsements. So the great news is we have lots already, and there's a list on our site, and we've got all the major commercial players covered, but there's always more. So we're always talking about that as well, how we might be able to you know, find and approach those kind of holdout publishers. And just sort of addressing how the code could continue to evolve. So
right, that was my next question. Exactly. What's on the front burner, so to speak?
Yeah, so we mentioned about the kind of revision cycle that we've got going, want to sort of look to the community to get feedback on that. So we've only just recently released the last version, But already, you know, we're sort of thinking about new kind of areas we might sort of move forward and look at a little bit further. So perhaps there are potential implications we want to cover for downstream services, such as PubMed, anything that we might want to cover there. That's light in the code at the moment. And we were working with the ISSN International Centre on the alerting service. There's also, we think, other opportunities to work with industry groups to kind of further our coverage. We've, for instance, been working for a number of years with the Keepers Registry, so looking at kind of preservation agreements and how that might work. There might also be something we could do around open access metadata. So lots of things kind of bubbling away there. But the kind of key thing, I guess, is, you know, our constituents, really. So we want people to read the code. If you're unsure about anything, or if there's any kind of gaps that people might consider are there, could need further kind of clarification, then that's exactly the kind of feedback that we are looking for and sort of need to make sure that the code continues to sort of adjust and evolve. I think I probably ought to mention as well, there are a few things that we have talked about that we haven't been able to include formally, and we might, I guess, issue some guidance notes about, but possibly not include in the main code. And that's because there are a few things we have to watch out for in terms of anti-competitive practices between the publishers. So we can't do anything that infringes on potential sort of contract terms, or you tell people how they ought to be kind of managing anything to do with kind of finances or sales models or anything like that. So one thing that was raised a little while back that we wanted to potentially look at was around deferred revenues that publishers have, but we decided that kind of thing couldn't be in the code mm-hmm. itself. But we might issue some sort of guidance notes around those. But it's worth sort of mentioning that there are a few bits and pieces that people might kind of want to see in the code that we have to tread a little bit more carefully over. So those.
Yep. Two. No, I understand that. NISO also has a. Flags on things that could be construed as anti-competitive. So,
yeah,
I hear you. So there's actually one thing I wanted to add that, you know, transfer covers the transfer journals between publishers, but actually the concept of transfer has affected a new project that's just started at NISO, and that's on content platform changes. So I think many people are aware that journals might move from publisher A to publisher B, but publishers themselves might change their hosting structure from provider one to provider two for, you know, their own business reasons, their own content management reasons, their own strategic reasons. And that also affects people, librarians, others in the industry, authentication, all kinds of various issues. So NISO has recently begun a new working group on content platform migrations, and like other NISO groups, like transfer, has involved different stakeholders in the industry, and we are certainly looking at transfer as a model of sorts for how to create recommendations that are endorsed by different players, and we do have Jennifer Basile, who is the other co-chair of transfer, is serving on this working group. So that working group has really only just started, I'd say last month. They've had two or three meetings now, but the transfer model is certainly enduring. So any other comments from either James or Linda about transfer, things that we haven't said that you want to be sure people take home with them? And then we'll open the floor to questions, which are always fun.
We've done a pretty good comprehensive sort of overview from my perspective. Linda, anything that you think we've missed?
No, I think I'm ready for questions.
Good. So folks on the call, if you muted your phone and you've been dying to say something, or even not dying to say something, we hope that you'd have questions for Linda or James about transfer or anything in this general area, things that you might have experienced or things that you've wondered. If you don't have questions, that's fine too, but it is an opportunity. Sounds
Hi,
like
could you tell me?
Oh, yes, great, hello. Great, please go ahead, sorry.
Could you tell me what's going to happen to the Keepers Registry? I see it's It will end on July 31st.
I had heard an announcement about that. Keepers is not a NYSO project. James, have you heard any? Have you heard anything specific?
No, I haven't. We're reaching out to find that. I think it's a in terms of kind of priorities and for funding from JISC that's making the difference there. So I'm not sure, but I've reached out to try and find more information. As I said, they've been really a helpful sort of organisation for us over the last couple of years in terms of making sure we were covering kind of preservation considerations effectively. So it'd be a shame to sort of lose that contact, although we do have some good contacts on the group as well with the large preservation arrangement kind of groups, so like Clocks and Portico as well. So we'll keep in touch one way or another, but I'm afraid I don't know any more than that at the moment. One thing to note that I'm not sure we did mention actually about the alerting service is that some of the information that publishers are asked to provide on that is what preservation agreements apply, and in the code publishers are strongly encouraged to maintain those arrangements, so referred to in the body, but I'm afraid I don't know what's happening.
It is pretty concerning because almost every transfer information panel, if you click on a title and you get the full panel of information about transferring on the transfer alerting service, almost all of them link to the keeper's registry. So I mean, if it's a matter of somebody else hosting it or something, I'm like, that's really bad. I guess I wasn't aware of it, and I really appreciate you bringing it up because we definitely need to figure out how to deal with that.
Yeah, definitely. As I've reached out, but I haven't heard anything back from them yet. Saving as a sort of a priorities question for JISC.
Yep. Any other questions? All right. So. What we usually do on these calls after the discussion has ended is I'm going to, just to let you know, I'm going to thank James and Linda. Thank you both very much for taking time from your busy days to think about what kinds of things you wanted to talk about and to talk about those with me. So thanks very much, James and Linda. Appreciate that. I'm going to stop the recording, but I'm going to stay on the line. And